Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Finding out you're having a baby can be very exciting, but at the same time, it can also be terrifying, especially when it comes to all the financial considerations you're going to need to have to think about. Alex Jassim and Nikita Stanley want to help you with that part. That's why they came up with the book, Get Your S Together, The Rebel Mama's Handbook for Financially Empowered Moms. They're going to be here to talk about that book with their characteristic sass and surprise. Then, psychedelics, something all parents could use, surely. We've been talking about medical cannabis for years and years and years. Today, we're going to talk about psychedelics, and that has new data on interventions in particular in the area of mental health. Matt Stang from Delic Corporation is here to talk about this unique, and maybe one day, this unique industry. And fighting fraud within the mortgage industry. A new Equifax survey found consumers expect more from their lenders to do to protect them to fight mortgage fraud. Equifax created a tool focused on just that thing. Carl Davies is here to tell us about ClearPro. And who's a good dog? Who's a good dog? Is your furry friend included in your will? If the answer is no, you might want to reconsider. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue is here to tell you why it's important to plan for your pet's future in case you leave this earth a little early. Plus, effectively planning for your retirement. Pat Struby is here to talk about his latest book, The Retirement Secret. Shh, don't tell anyone. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Surprise! You're having a baby! Okay, so that's great. You peed on the stick. Awesome. Now what? There are so many things that you now have to think about when starting this new chapter of your life. One of those many, 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 many things is your finances. My next two guests wrote a book together to help with that particular angle. It's called Get Your S Together, Get Your S Together, you fill in the blank there, The Rebel Mama's Handbook for Financially Empowered Moms. Alex Jassim and Nikita Stanley join me now to talk about birthing their book. Hello there.
Hi.
Hello.
How did you two meet? That has got to be my first question. How did you two meet? Was it in a play group? Was it prior to kids?
It was prior to kids, and we were party friends. So our life was vastly different from the one that we have today.
Oh my God. Yes. Did you ever fear that it might not weather the transition from mascara to baby vomit in your hair?
Why, yes, we did worry about that. Funny you should ask.
And how did you resolve that? Nikita, how did you resolve that?
We started speaking our specific truth and putting it out into the world, and it got a really good, people started to really resonate with it. So the ex-party girls and mommy group dropouts, which we like to refer to ourselves as, we got together and we started something a little bit different for moms who are a little bit different.
Moms who are a little bit different. Tell me about the Rebel Mamas. When you use that phrase, what does it mean? Alex.
We are rebelling against society's expectations of what moms should be and what we need to, you know, look like and do and say. So we're kind of telling women to keep their identity intact when they have kids, not let go of that party girl. For the record, we still are party girls.
Okay.
It's so just a little bit less frequent and more well-organized and a little bit classier, but I just want to say that we have held on to our identity as well.
Right. And yes. you call the night at 1 a.m. instead of 6 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
For the very most smart. Part.
So in the book, it says you've used this phrase, for 6 years, we smashed stigmas and dismantled taboos to empower parents, but we've been overlooking the most important piece of the puzzle, money. How did that insight hit you? Where did that come from? That you're like, wait a second, we need to add this into our toolkit.
Well, it started because we really noticed that there was a major power imbalance happening in our society. And after years of trying to figure this out, we really landed on the fact that this imbalance is maintained by keeping women financially disadvantaged. So while we spent the first 6 years and, you know, our first book and all of our 500 blog posts empowering women to mother on their own terms and advocate for their own needs and take no BS, we realized that what we really needed to do was to get women set on a clear-cut path to financial freedom and improve their financial literacy. And that's how we're going to kind of correct this imbalance that we're seeing.
Yeah. Alex, what was the insight for you personally, or were you always astute did you walk into the bar knowing that you were not going to fall victim to the allure of bottle service?
What?
I will not be a bottle service customer tonight. I will have one sidecar and go on.
In terms of finance, you mean?
I don't need party tips. I do okay, not need good. Party tips. I have an 11-year-old. I'm good.
You know, this
that's
is
another
something,
episode.
Yeah, this is something we weren't well versed on ourselves before we wrote this book. It was the first book we wrote more from experience and how we felt about parenting and our approach. And this book took a lot of research and a lot of things we then applied to our own lives. So budgeting, personal budgeting, the way we budget in our business, getting all our wills and our life insurance and all those things ticked off too. We sort of applied that and got organized, but it's been eye-opening. And honestly, 2020 was probably the best year it could have happened
yeah.
for this book to come out, because it yeah. really brought everything up to the forefront and up to the surface. And everybody was having those conversations anyway. So now we can facilitate that.
Nikita, you begin with the notion of getting your mind right, is how you phrase it. You ask a series of open-ended questions. Money is, money makes me feel. What are you trying to get readers to do or engage in?
You know, women have a really emotional attachment to money, more so than men do. Men are able to kind of compartmentalize and separate themselves from the numbers. Women have a harder time doing that. And what we discovered while we were researching the book is that money really is black and white, and you have to use your practical brain for that. So while the, you know, emotional attachments we have to money are important and we need to acknowledge those in order to move past them, the key is that we have to move past them. So we wanted people to acknowledge how they're feeling about money. Maybe they picked up this book because money gives them massive anxiety, or, you know, they feel inadequate or whatever it is. So we wanted our readers right off the hop to understand that that is a part of this, but also to understand that, like, now it's time to set that aside and put on our practicality hats and go about this in a really pragmatic way.
Many women, Alex, are married to dudes or partnered with dudes. Not all moms are. There are many, many single moms. There are many moms who are married to another woman, but there are many moms who are married to dudes or partnered with dudes, parenting with dudes. How do you tackle the money conversation with a male partner? And I say male intentionally because there's going to be some different gender dynamics there.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, my husband too was usually in charge of the finances. So I totally get that angle. But, you know, a good place to start is to talk about your upbringings and your money stories, because they have informed your relationship with finance. So if we start talking about how we were raised with our partners and see where your attitudes come, that says a lot. You can also bring something concrete to the table to get the conversation going, like an article, which there are so many of, or our book, if you want to slide it across the table, you know, like just something to chat about and kind of give each other an idea of what your money goals really look like and what you want to do and work towards together, right? Because if you're not having those conversations and not having that communication, who knows if you're on the same page, right?
Nikita, there is a lot of swearing in this book, so much so that there's
there?
A glossary.
Oh my god!
I can't imagine you. And luckily, I told you couldn't swear on this show. You have a glossary at the top that outlines it, and it feels similar to Thug Kitchen, the vegan cookbook, in that it's a part of the tone. Yeah, it's a part of the tone. And so I want to ask you about how you thought about that tone and how you ensured that it was an authentic voice when you wrote a book for a mainstream publisher?
Well, it kind of is a continuation of our first book, which is The Rebel Mama's Handbook for Cool Moms, which is also extremely sweary. And when we kind of came onto the scene about 6 years ago, that was really not something that was happening in the mom space at all. Moms are very edited, whether they do it themselves or somebody else edits them. And we were like, forget that. This is how moms talk. Motherhood is very frustrating. Sometimes you need to get it out. Sometimes, you know, I have an English specialist degree, and I really do believe that curse words are just an expletive part of language that, you know, I think it's an important tool. So we utilize that tool a lot. And as Alex said, there were so many more in there that we ended up on our last
cut.
We should remove these.
Right. That's a little beau couture. You cover the waterfront in terms of planning, earning, spending, debt, savings. Like, it really is a great survey course in finances. What is the one thing that you would want people to ensure they understood in the planning phase as it relates to kids? Because there's so many books. There's 12,000 books about money. I wrote 2 books about money. But this is very on point for someone who is expecting or caring for a newborn.
Yeah, well, we wanted to make it quick and digestible because we know that moms don't really have that much time. And we also, you know, we listened to our audience a lot and we wanted to answer the questions that they had. And the biggest question that would come up was, where do I even start? So it was really important for us to give a full, we couldn't just dive right into investing, you know, we really had to give that full overview of like, what does this look like? What are the parts of this puzzle? Like, earning is the first thing you have to do before you can consider spending and before you can consider saving and all that. So it was really important for us to lay it out in a way that was kind of like a roadmap almost. Like, this is what it's going to take to get your beep together.
Yes. And we researched everything for them, and that was the plan too. So it's like an easy guideline. It's not an extensive encyclopedia of everything. And, you know, we've kind of short form, here are the things you're going to need when you have a baby. Here are the things you have to sign up for. Here are government programs. I mean, this is mostly for Canada, but we do speak to the US a little bit. And, you know, to get mom prepped, because there's so much to think about and it's so overwhelming. And that's why everybody falls into retail therapy right away and starts nesting. It's more fun to spend money than to think about wills, right?
I want to ask you, Alex, about how you think about, you call it mindful consumerism. The shots in the book are Instagram ready. Your demographic lives on social media. There is so much pressure to buy and to do, you know, you got to have the bottle warmers or you're going to be a terrible parent if you don't have the baby wipe warmer even. How do you help your readers navigate that without racking up enormous amounts of debt and having like a baby Bjorn to match every outfit?
Well, we want them to stop and think, first of all, and take a hard look at exactly what they're buying and what comes with those purchases, and just kind of start making better everyday decisions and start realizing what's just, you know, retail marketing. So we have a little hand-drawn chart in the book that is like your flow chart sort of roadmap.
I love that.
When you pick something up and you think, oh my God, it's so cute, I need it, because you get that like instant feeling, go through the process for a second and pause and like really think, do I have something like this? Can I repair something like this? Do I truly need it? And no, by the way, you don't need like $2,000 baby cribs and things like that. Like, the baby industry will have you believe, you know, you can make smarter decisions.
Nikita, I want to sneak in one last question here. The acknowledgements include thanks to Weed for helping us conjure up unexpected and clever ways to ensure that this money book was not like the rest, boring. Tell me why you decided to include that, from the fact that it's your lived experience.
I mean, I think it's really important to us to be authentic and to be transparent about who we are and what we do. And yeah, cannabis is an important part of our creative process. And so we thought we'd offered a little shout out in there. You know, we wrote the book in quarantine for the most part. And cannabis really helped us separate from, you know, real life to book writing. So that was, it deserves a little shout out in there.
I can't even imagine. It wasn't available legally when I was writing my book. So maybe that's my out. Alex,
time to write another one.
No. Thank you both so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
The book is called Get Your S Together, The Rebel Mama's Handbook for Financially Empowered Moms. Alex Jassim and Nikita Stanley, the co-authors of that book.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Remember the debate to legalize cannabis? It seems like 1,000 years ago that we were talking about it. Now there is a super cool, funky branded cannabis shop on almost every corner in this country. It is really easy to invest in the cannabis category too, for better or for worse, because those stocks have been up and those stocks have been down. But I think investors are right to consider what's next. Could it be psychedelics? I know. Matt Stang is the CEO of Delic Corp. He joins me now from Los Angeles to talk about it. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
You have been, you were in the cannabis space for what, 17 years or something. What?
That is correct.
What attracted you to this next thing, to looking at psychedelics?
That is a great question. You know, I have been at the forefront of the legalization movement for, as you said, the better part of 2 decades. Having, you know, owned and operated High Times, one of the largest media and events brands in cannabis, I saw another tipping point. So I lived through the tipping point of cannabis in the 2010 to 2014 era. And I saw another tipping point coming for psychedelics about 2.5 years ago. So my wife and I founded Delic as the world's first psychedelic wellness corporation. And, you know, strategically, we're here to help facilitate safe and effective access to psychedelic wellness. And that's, I think, really, it's happening right now. The science is amazing. The science is better than anything cannabis had behind it for the efficacy and safety of psychedelics for healing your mental trauma or mental instabilities or whatever other kind of mental health issues you might suffer from.
I'm sure you have heard and hear all the drug references and the jokes like you would have in your days in cannabis, but psychedelics as a treatment option can make a huge difference for people, as you alluded to. Can you give me some examples of where people use that as an intervention and the sort of outcomes that they see?
Absolutely. So right now, Delic, it owns a chain of ketamine clinics in the greater Southwest of America, and people can go in and get treated for treatment-resistant depression, anxiety, PTSD, obsessive compulsive disorders. It's almost magical how it works. It's a dissociative drug that's been proven safe for many decades as an anesthesia. And over the last dozen or so years, the science has come behind it incredibly well. And it's the only FDA licensed clinical therapeutic as of right now. Now, behind that are a wave of psychedelics that are coming to market soon. So you have MDMA from the folks at MAPS. They've spent better part of 3 decades working to get that pushed through, and they're at the, you know, the 1 yard line, if you like football analogies. You have Compass Pathways with their psilocybin that is probably at the 5 yard line, maybe a year or so away. And both these substances have been granted breakthrough therapy, and the numbers just don't lie. You have, you know, stuff that the current mental health treatments will have somewhere around a 4 to 5% efficacy year over year, meaning 4 to 5% of people taking them are clinically better. When you look at psilocybin and MDMA, those numbers get closer to 70%. Wow. So you're talking about it a 12 to 15x return, which when someone is depressed and going to kill themselves or so traumatized that they throw their daughter across the room or can't hold down a job, you know, that this is not minor stuff. This is the most major stuff. Mm. And I think, you know, you're looking at this is a huge wave of mental health issues coming out of this pandemic. You have you know, suicides are triple. You have
eating disorders.
Eating disorders.
A thousand things. I want to ask you, in the beginning of legalization for cannabis, there was a medical marijuana path, and there was also legalization for the leisure market, in part because it would disrupt some of the illegal activity. At least that was my how I inferred the rationale here. You've spoken about the mental health benefits of psychedelics. Is there a leisure market here too?
Yeah, and that's where you get to the wellness market, right? So why we say psychedelic wellness, you can be not mentally ill, but still not at peak performance. And this is where I think the kind of Silicon Valley ethos comes in, where people are optimizing their lives, right? So I think there's a huge push behind health optimization, behind biohacking, behind paleo. And you know, my wife was one of the founding folks at Bulletproof, one of the first paleo companies.
Yeah, the coffee, right?
Uh-huh. So she knows that world very well. So we really come at this from a wellness side. So we do think there is the FDA clinical path, which we're pursuing, but there's also, you know, you look at a state like Oregon just legalized mushrooms for therapeutic purposes, but not through FDA scheduling. So you'll be able to go into a retreat or clinical setting, but not necessarily a doctor setting. And you don't have to have a mental illness to qualify to utilize psilocybin to better your life. And there's just, I mean, if you read How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, Ezra Klein's last column in the New York Times about his psychedelic trip, there's just, you know, the amount of people who are not unwell, but are stuck and kind of feeling disconnected or feeling unmotivated, who can find this incredibly powerful boost in psychedelics. And I think mushrooms are probably the tip of the spear there, because they're the safest, they're all natural, they have no toxicity, they have antithetical to abuse, because the more you take, the less they activate. So there's just a lot that is, I think, in favor of that. So yes, I think you will see a dual market, both wellness and medical.
Your company is publicly traded. It's a small cap. Some people would even say micro cap, but it does trade. How do you think, it's a hard question to ask you because you're not going to be objective on the answer, but how should people think about investing in the sector, given how long the timelines could be and how uncertain they can be, given that it's government and the courts who are going to determine whether there is real market potential here?
For sure. And I think that's how we've thought about Delic, right? We've built something that is the companies that we've purchased into our company are all cash flowing current businesses. We're not asking people to wait 7 to 10 years for a drug to come online. We have real cash flowing businesses that are touching the psychedelic space today. We have as I said, a series of ketamine clinics, a lab up in Canada that has the Health Canada license to work with psilocybin and cannabis. And so I think what I would say to that is there's going to be some real long-term amazing things, but there's also, I think, a highly investable asset class in psychedelics right now. And that's what we're bringing people, is the ability to invest in the current ability to scale and grow the psychedelic marketplace. And so we have a bunch of assets just for that.
If you were to have told the teenage me that I would be having this conversation in 2021, I never would have believed you. Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time.
Matt Stang is the CEO of Delic Corporation. They call themselves an umbrella platform for psychedelics. Just the world is an amazing place. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, fighting mortgage fraud. Carl Davies from Equifax tells us more about their new tool called ClearPro. And later, how to effectively plan for your retirement. We'll look at a new book called The Retirement Secret. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter is available at moolala.ca. You sign up, you put your email address in there, and then you're going to get all the fun stuff that I've done on this show and CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and all that stuff. It comes once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. A recent survey from Equifax found that consumers expect lenders to do more to protect them from mortgage fraud. But how can we fight fraud within the mortgage industry? Equifax created a tool that is designed to help with that. Carl Davis is the head of fraud and identity at Equifax Canada. He joins us now to talk more about mortgage fraud, how we can fight it, and Equifax's new tool called ClearPro. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Great to be here today.
What is mortgage fraud? I mean, I think I can describe lots of other types of fraud, but clearly I am not a criminal mind. I can't think of how I would actually cheat that part of the financial services sector. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, the most common way that mortgage fraud presents itself is usually in something we call misrepresentation. So that's where, you know, parties involved in the transaction are misrepresenting some portion of information in order to get that mortgage that otherwise they wouldn't have been able to get. So, for example, it could be me as a consumer saying I earn that, you know, extra $30,000, $40,000 every year. But interestingly, as I mentioned, it can be anybody in that transaction. It could be the broker, could even be the appraiser, and in rare cases, the lender as well.
So I can see how the consumer would be tempted to do that. Like, if I make a whole lot more money, then you're going to give me a whole lot more money to borrow. What's in it for the broker? Why would they be incented to take on fraudulent behavior?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, the broker gets paid on funded deals, right? So if they can get more applications through and more applications approved by the lender and, you know, achieving that by increasing somebody's salary, then they're more likely to achieve that commission. And, you know, there's, I say, as we're going through COVID, although house prices are spiking, the number of deals are reducing, right? Inventory is really small. So, you know, I think there's a lot of impetus for people involved in that transaction to do more in these times.
Any idea how common mortgage fraud is?
It's maybe not as common as some other types of fraud that we see, things like identity theft. I think the issue with mortgage fraud is that, you know, the assets are so high in value that it can become exponential in the terms of losses that we see.
A lot of fraud in online dating, I hear. So less than that, somewhat less than that.
Somewhat
less than that. You did a survey on this topic. And one of the surprising things to me anyway, was that 16% of millennials said it was okay to overstate your income. Mm-hmm. Did that surprise you?
You know, we've been doing this survey for a number of years, and every year I will say I'm surprised by that number. You know, the fact that people think that's a victimless crime, you know, actually isn't true. And so to have that number of millennials believe that's okay, I think we said 11% believe mortgage fraud is a victimless crime and 16% of millennials say it was okay to do that. I'm consistently surprised by that. There were a number of surprising results in the survey, but that one is always one that surprises me.
What else surprised you?
So for me, it was some of the, not necessarily related to mortgage fraud, but some of the reasons people were concerned about mortgage fraud. I think one of the ones that stood out was the number of people who were concerned with having to prove that they were in fact the victim when it came to fraud. You know, and that to me is like, that's shocking, right? Because somebody's really dealing with, you know, what's quite a personal invasion of somebody taking over your identity to then have to feel there's a significant burden on making sure that you're proving that you were in fact the victim. That one to me was very eye-opening.
Mm. Equifax has launched something called Clear Pro, as I referenced off the top. What does that do?
Right. So Clear Pro is a service that we've developed. You know, the best way I think about it, it's trying to ensure that consumers have trust in the people that they're doing business with. So if I'm a, you know, if I'm a mortgage broker involved in a transaction, you know, I want to make sure that the consumer trusts me. Like I'd say, the vast majority of brokers out there are trustworthy and important members in terms of getting people into homes. But we need to be able to trust them. So consumer trust and protecting your brand as an employer of the mortgage broker is very, very important. If I'm employing a broker and they're representing my brand out to the public, there's a lot of reputational risk there. So it's, for me, it's a lot about consumer trust.
And how does Clear Pro work? I mean, Equifax is very good at getting data from many, many sources to come up with a credit score. So you are using, I assume, a similar approach to try and get data from many, many different places. What data goes into a Clear Pro assessment?
Yeah, so there's a number of pieces of information that we're looking at. And you're absolutely right. The best way to look at and even prevent fraud is to look at multiple different pieces of data, multiple different behaviors. So we're actually using some parts of the credit bureau, nothing really to do with the traditional use of a credit bureau. Like, I'm not really interested if somebody has a score of 800 or 600. That really doesn't indicate to me whether somebody is fraudulent or not. But there could be other markers on the credit bureau. For example, if somebody has 35 aliases or AKA names, that is likely more indicative of some kind of fraud risk.
People have that many aliases?
Yeah, we've seen it on the credit file. And you know what? Those are instances where people are at a higher risk of fraud. Not always, but you know, there's a higher risk of fraud being perpetrated by an identity that looks like that.
Are you speaking about a consumer or a broker here when you talk about that?
So it could be either. Remember that you know, when we're looking at a credit report, that could cover anybody. It could be anybody in any Canadian consumer or broker, or you know, anybody really. So what with ClearPro, what we're doing is we're making this available to the mortgage brokerages, you know, the people who would employ brokers, and we're saying, hey, let us check this for you. We're looking at, you know, some attributes on the credit bureau, not related to credit. This isn't going to impact people's credit scores, but it will look at some of those risk factors. Obvious ones like, you know, do you have a judgment on file? But other areas such as, you know, do you have 25 different alias names? That could be one interesting thing. We're also looking at services that will try and identify if the broker's been involved in something untoward recently. So, for example, we do both domestic and international media screening to make sure that, you know, Carl hasn't come from Wales and has done something untoward back in his homeland. Also checking sanctions lists to look at whether it's PEP or OFAC to make sure such names don't appear there. We're also looking at a data source that Equifax holds that looks at misuse of certain pieces of information. So for example, if my social insurance number has been misused in the past, it will get flagged there and then alerted to the brokerage at the point they're onboarding that broker. The one thing I would like to point out is what we're doing here is we're not actually saying, yes, this person is fraudulent. We're just trying to highlight some of the risks that may be available for that brokerage to look at so that they can make the right decision.
And what does ClearPro produce as a score? I mean, with the credit score, it's super simple. We've got benchmarks, you know, we kind of have a sense for what a 600 is versus an 800. Does ClearPro have a score, or does it just say to the brokerage, you need to take a closer look at this individual?
It's the latter. We say, hey, you know, there are some risk flags that we've identified. Here's the information. So for example, you know, there may be something in the media and here's some articles you may need to check, or yes, there's a potential hit on one of the sanctions lists that we've checked. So again, it's not a score because again, a score is very boundary driven, right? If somebody's in this bucket, then they are good. And if they're in this bucket, they're not. What we're trying to do with ClearPro is give the employer as much information as we can with any risk flags that may be present so that they can take that forward, do the appropriate diligence, and hopefully, you know, take the right step.
And what would be the step? So if someone's flagged by ClearPro, what happens then?
Again, completely up to the brokerage at that point. We would expect them to take the information, do their diligence, and at that point, the decision of how they proceed is entirely up to them.
From a consumer standpoint, as it relates to fraud, what are the consequences of making false claims on a mortgage application? And is there a range of terribleness, for lack of a better phrase? Like, yeah, if you lie about that, it's no big deal. But if you lie about that, that's a really big deal. Like, don't be saying your alias is Lord Snowden, because that's like, for Welsh people, that's a crime.
That's terrible. I mean, there's many different consequences. I mean, I'm a career fraud person. So anytime somebody is engaging in fraudulent activity, to my mind, it's not great. I mean, the levels.
That's an understatement. That is an understatement.
So, the levels of terribleness in terms of what we're doing, it will range upon the type of fraud, you know, the implications in terms of, you know, what the financial loss may be to all parties involved. My general advice to everybody would be, don't do it. It probably is not worth it. It is not worth your time in the slightest.
Wow. Okay. That'll be our number one takeaway. Carl Davis from Equifax said, don't do fraud. Wow. Amazing. Carl, thank you for your time today.
You are very welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
Carl Davis is Welsh. Clearly, he is also the head of fraud and identity at Equifax Canada. And he was here to talk about mortgage fraud broadly, but also about the new Equifax tool called ClearPro. Stay with us. Coming up later, Pat Struby's new book, The Retirement Secret. But first, the importance of planning for your pet, your pet's future, if you're not around. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue Wills will be here. If you have missed an episode of this show, do not worry. You can go to any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon, whatever it is. Find past episodes. While you're there, give us a review. Subscribe to the next episode. Your reward will be great in whatever afterlife you choose.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you have a beloved furry little friend in your life, you know that many pet owners consider that pet to be a member of the family. You might even believe it's important to plan for your pet's future in case you leave this earth prematurely. But you may not actually be following through and making those arrangements in the way that you should be. Joining us now to talk about why you might want to think about your pet when it comes to your estate planning and how you go about doing that is Daniel Goldgut. He is co-founder and CEO of Epilogue, an online will preparation tool. Hello, Daniel. How you doing?
Hi, Bruce. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
If you do nothing, you do not say anything about your cat, dog, ferret, lizard, and you die, what happens?
It's a good question. And it depends a little bit. So pets, in the eyes of the law, are considered to be property. So just like any other property that you have, that property is going to be disposed of.
So that was you realize that's a trigger warning for pet owners. I can't believe you uttered that phrase on the air, as accurate as it is. You have called Sparkle and Betty and Betsy property. Scandalous. Well,
I did say in the eyes of the law.
And yes, eyes of the law.
That's, I guess, where the big distinction gets made. People, as you said, off the top, view their pets much more like they view their children than they do their couch. And so, whereas in a will, when it comes to children, you're naming a guardian for your children. With pets, the term used is often guardian, but that's not really what you're doing. You're actually giving a gift of your pet to a specific person. Now, we know that that person is going to take on a guardianship role, But when you include a pet in your will, what you are doing is giving that pet as a gift to a specific person.
If you don't make that arrangement, if you don't specify, what happens? Like if you're a single person, you don't have a will, your stuff gets passed, I assume, passed to next of kin.
That's right.
Your dog goes too?
That's right. So in whatever province you are in, there are rules about what happens if you pass away without a will. And generally speaking, it follows a list as far as next of kin. So as you said, if you are a single person with no spouse and no kids, in most provinces, it's going to go up to your parents if your parents are alive. And no parents, it's going to go to siblings, nieces and nephews. And so because your pet is considered property, it's just going to be part of that, part of your assets that's going to go to whoever the province decides it should go to.
Right. Okay. So that's the, I didn't think about it, I didn't write it down method. What is the method of, no, I'm actually going to think about this. How does one choose whom should receive the gift of the pet?
So another really good question, and that obviously there's a lot of considerations out there. Are there other pet owners in your life? Are there other people in your life that know your pet, that understand how you care for your pet? And are there people who could sort of do the best job at giving your pet the life that they're, I'll call it, accustomed to? Mm. And so to love them and care for them in the way that you do. And so, you know, is there someone who lives close so that it's familiar for your pet, as opposed to, you know, to the cousin in Nova Scotia who might be your next of kin? And what would that look like for your pet?
Why do you think that so few families make arrangements for their pets?
I mean, I think there's probably two main reasons. I mean, the first is that so few people make arrangements at all.
At all.
And so that carries through, right? Like there's, you know, more than 50% of Canadian adults don't have a will at all, which means that not only have they not thought about their pets, but they haven't named guardians for children. They haven't named an executor. So, I mean, that's that first chunk of people who haven't done anything at all. And the second category, which might be a little bit tied to the first, is people just assume that everything is going to work out. You know, everyone will be reasonable and the person that should step up will step up. But that's just not how it works, right? Because the distribution is somewhat governed by the rules of the province, there's not so much, call it, wiggle room. And so it is challenging to not plan for it in terms of what happens later. What if there's multiple people that think they're the right person? There's just sort of a host of issues that get created when you've done no planning at all.
Now, prior to Epilogue, you did work as a traditional estate lawyer, like in an office and doing these big, complicated estate plans. Did you see in that practice where pets became an issue?
Somewhat. So, I mean, I should say, when people think about pets in wills, oftentimes they think about sort of the cases that make the news. You know, the stories in the U.S. about someone creating a trust for their pet and leaving $50 million in it and stuff like that. That's the stuff that's sort of noteworthy. That's not what happens generally. I mean, in Canada and Ontario specifically, you can't do something like that. But you see the cases where, you know, someone just doesn't make any arrangements and no one steps forward. And then that's a real challenge, or maybe no one outside the family, but they're not really now involved in this process, because if there was no planning that was done whatsoever, there's sort of a limited pool of people who are, call it, even eligible, and it can create a lot of issues.
Mm. So the pet would end up, in that case, the pet would end up at the Humane Society.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. It would, you know, the person who would get the pet, because they were the one, according to the province, who should be in charge. If that person decided that they didn't want that pet, and the responsibilities that came with it, they would make their own decision about what would happen.
We have talked on this show about Epilogue and how, you know, the technology allows you to prompt users for think about this, think about this, think about this. Are pets a prompt on Epilogue, or do you have to know to tell that will creation software that you have a pet and you want to make a proper plan?
Yeah. So they are a prompt. So we ask the question, do you have any pets? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you are going to see another question that says, do you want to name a guardian for your pet? And like I said before, that's not, call it the legal term, but that is the term that people recognize, and that's right. Understandable. So we say, do you want to name a guardian for your pet? And if someone chooses to do so, then we ask, do you want to name an alternate guardian? So if the person that you originally named is unable or unwilling to do it, is there someone else that you want to be there as a backup? And then we ask one more question, which is, do you want to make a gift, a monetary gift to that person, either as a token of your appreciation or right. to actually assist with the care,
cover
of the
pet. Food and the vet bills.
Yeah, and it's different if it's a dog or a cat or a horse as far yeah. as what upkeep looks like and what costs look like, and so you know that's also entirely optional, but we give people that ability.
Now, pets don't live as long as humans. If you've got a dog or a cat, it could be 10 years, it could be 15 years, but it's not 30 years. How do you ensure that you keep that? That will up to date. Do you name the pet, or do you just say, in the event that I die and I've got pets, here is how that would be resolved?
Yeah. So I think there's probably some different practices out there. At Epilogue, our practice is to not name the pet specifically and to say, the language, and it's a bit legalese in terms of what the will actually says, but it's sort of, in the vein of any domestic animals living with me at the time of my death. They would go. And you're absolutely right. I think, people in their, 30s and 40s and 50s who are making wills, who have a pet, whose life expectancy is certainly shorter than their own, sometimes don't think about it or don't think it's necessary. But it is, right? Like in the sense that you want to plan for everything and your wishes should reflect your situation right now. And yeah. if in 3 or 5 or 10 years those change, you should update your will accordingly.
Really interesting stuff. Daniel, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Daniel Goldgut is the co-founder and CEO of Epilogue, which is an online will preparation tool. We were talking about how to ensure that your pet is cared for in the event of your death. Stay with us. Coming up next, planning for retirement can be really overwhelming. So how can you make sure that you are doing the best job as early as you can? Pat Strube shares his tips from his new book, The Retirement Secret. I'll use my Wiley interviewing ways to get Pat to reveal the secret. You'll have to stay tuned.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Retirement planning can really, really be overwhelming. And it's not often easy to know if you're heading in the right direction or not. So how do you get prepared? Pat Strube's latest book is called The Retirement Secret, A Simple Approach to financial peace of mind. He's aiming to lay out the foundation to effectively plan for your retirement. And he joins us now to talk more about his approach. Pat joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello there.
Bruce, how you doing?
It's called The Retirement Secret. So tell me, what's the secret? What's the secret? I want to know immediately, what's the secret?
You're dying to know, right?
Dying to know.
Well, we've worked as a financial planning group helping people to try to retire for the last 23 years. And you hit the nail on the head just a moment ago. It's figuring out how to retire is just overwhelming for most people. And we call it the do-it-yourself retirement system, because most people have to figure out how to invest themselves. Mm. So the secret that's laid out in the book is just a way to think of how to look at your savings and investments. So it talks about kind of putting those in three different categories. So rather than being overwhelmed, it keeps it simple so that you can focus on what you're trying to accomplish.
What are those three categories?
Well, we like to look at it, if you would visualize like building a house with three levels. Now I'm no architect, so my house looks very simple when I'm drawing it out. But the bottom level is going to be the foundation of your house. So of course we need that to be very strong. So that's going to be any type of place you can put your money that's going to be safe or guaranteed, like a bank account or an annuity that has some type of contractual guarantees. On the flip side, if we go to the top of the house, that's your roof of the house. So that's going to be the most exposed to the elements. that's going to be the most growth oriented or the most risky. And that's what so many people think of when they think of investing, like the stock market or something like that. So we define that as anything that would fluctuate on a day by day or minute by minute basis. And then the middle of your house is the walls. It's connecting the foundation to the roof. And for simplicity, we basically said the walls is anything in between there. It's not guaranteed, and it's not subject to the whims of the stock market on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute basis.
What would be an example of that? Like, would a bond ETF be like a wall?
It could be. What we have found, a common example that fits there is real estate, because a lot of you can either own real estate physically, or you can be in a real estate investment that's, you know, someone's managing for you. And that could be very, you know, if it has some privately held real estate, it could be much more stable. But a lot of times people are looking for income in those walls investments. So maybe you can generate 4 or 5 or 6% dividends there. So not nearly as much upside as the roof, as the stock market, but something that's going to provide more than that safe guaranteed account.
Now, you write sort of in a parable. It was Dick and Jane, now Jack and Jill. You could have been a little more creative with the names. Like, you pop those in a baby name algorithm, and yeah, they're going to come up with something a little more interesting. I will park that to the side and ask you why you chose that storytelling format.
Well, I actually, I wrote the first chapter of my first book, Save Your Retirement, and I put it away and I thought, oh man, that was so good. Everyone's going to love this. And then I came back to it a couple of days later and I started reading it, and I was falling off my chair. I was falling asleep. It was so boring. Right. Because finance books or textbooks are so boring. And so it was just necessity. I don't know, you know, when I had the idea, but Save Your Retirement is about, you know, Dick and Jane meet these 7 retirement villains, and we talk about how to protect yourself from them. And I'm just thankful that it worked out that way. We got tremendous feedback about the book because people really love that approach.
You should have gone with Brad and Angelina. I think that would have sold you even more copies, I think. So speaking of the villains, longevity, fees, taxes, and inflation are some of the ones that you mentioned. If you had to choose one of the 7 villains that you would want people to know about, or maybe you'd choose it because it's the least understood, which would it be?
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit, if that's okay. I'm going to take the first 2 in the book were there intentionally. That is Lady Longevity and the invisible enemy, which is inflation, because to me, those go hand in hand. Mm. You know, if the cost of milk goes up 3% this year, that's not that big of a deal to most of us. But what happens is if we want to be retired for 10, 20, 30 plus years, and things are getting more expensive every year, this is a mathematical equation that none of us have ever had to deal with before. And really, you know, people retiring now are some of the first generations that are ever having to deal with it. And that brings us back to the question that's on everyone's mind: how do I make sure I never run out of money? And of course, as you know very well, it's hard to know because we don't know how long we're going to be here. And so those 2, I think, are so important to understand as you're making your decisions and planning your retirement.
I want to come back to your house analogy. So foundation, walls, and roof. How does one think through what percentage of one's nest egg should be in those 3 things? And this is where your analogy might fall down here, because there's a lot of money put into a foundation, less so in a roof.
Yes. So that's a very good point.
I can get a roof for 12 grand. I can't get a foundation for 12 grand.
That's really good. Yeah. So it's such a good point, because one of the big aha moments I've had in my career is everyone talks about the highest rate of return on their investments. That's actually not the most important thing. The most important thing with your money is accomplishing your goals. So, you know, if you're saving for if you're saving for a down payment on a house and you need it in 6 months, that is miles different than if you're saving for retirement in 20 or 30 years. And so we have to think about our money very differently. So the first step is understanding where are our goals. If we're planning for retirement, are we decades away? Are we weeks away? And that's going to, of course, dramatically determine where we're going to be. Someone who is decades away may be comfortable putting almost everything in the roof, right? Because, you know, they can ride out the storm and the ups and the downs, and, you know, maybe just in the foundation is just their emergency reserve. But what we find, a lot of our clients are within 5 years of retirement, they're starting to figure out, how in the world am I going to live off of this money? And that's when we start looking at shifting some of that from the roof into foundation and walls and trying to find vehicles that will actually generate income for them to live off of. Mm.
You write about something called the super retirement planner. Does the book include a cape? Is there a cape that comes in the
cover?
You
have such good ideas. I wish you would have told me before the book.
I should have. I would rename your people. There would be a cape. Yeah, all of it. You're welcome. Book number three, you call me.
All right, let's get to work.
So what's the super retirement planner?
Well, what we really want is, one of the things I point out in this most recent book, The Retirement Secret, is there is no such thing as unbiased financial advice. And my point there is not that a bias is necessarily negative, but that we all have these opinions. And what you need to find, if you're most people don't want to do all this by themselves. They want to have some type of guidance. And whether that's a large company that's helping, you know, with the puppet strings, or a one-on-one relationship like we do with our clients, you need to find someone that has a similar philosophy to what you have. And that's what I lay out. You know, part of the reason I wrote the books is we have a strong feeling about our philosophy. We don't think every dollar for everyone should be in the stock market. We don't think every dollar should be in the bank. There should be a mixture of those types of things. So finding someone that's a good fit for you and the goals you're trying to accomplish, we think just can provide tremendous value and peace of mind.
What's your single biggest piece of advice for when people need to move from accumulation to decumulation? Because I talk to people all the time. We're like, we do not talk enough about decumulation. It's a mindset shift. It's a portfolio shift. What's your advice as people make that transition?
Wow, that's a fabulous point. And I explain to clients, this is almost like a new era of our industry, because most of the financial world doesn't even think about decumulation, right? So you're absolutely right. I would say my biggest piece of advice on that is, don't wait too long to discuss it, because we have clients that are successfully planning that transition 5 to 10 years prior to retirement, because they don't want to get caught. You know, the last thing you want to do is be all in the roof and thinking everything is great. And then right before you're planning to make that transition, then the whole thing crashes down, right? So what you need to do is be thinking about, how much do I have exposed, and start considering how to start making those shifts probably earlier than you realize.
Pat Strube, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. This was great.
Pat's book is called The Retirement Secret, A Simple Approach to Financial Peace of Mind. He's got some very boring names for characters in there, but just swap them in for something a little bit more interesting, and it's a good read. All right, that is our show for today. Thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. If you would like to stay up to date on all things Moolala, don't forget to subscribe to the newsletter. It's at moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast at any of the podcast platforms that you currently listen to podcasts on. If you have a money question that you want answered, you can send it our way by emailing your questions, your comments, whatever it is, to ask@moolala.ca. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.